In our new series, World War II's Greatest Battles, we chart five pivotal moments that shaped the course of the conflict with military historian James Holland. New episodes drop every Thursday on the History Extra podcast.
This episode is brought to you by Indeed. We're driven by the search for better, but when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/History Extra. Just go to Indeed.com/History Extra right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Get ready for the greatest roast of all time. The Roast of Tom Brady. A Netflix live event happening May 5th. Hosted by Kevin Hart. The seven-time world champion gets his cleats held to the fire by famous friends and frenemies on an unforgettable night where everything is fair game. Tune in on May 5th at 5 p.m. Pacific time for The Roast of Tom Brady. Live only on Netflix.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Welcome to the History Extra podcast. Fascinating historical conversations from the makers of BBC History Magazine. In today's Everything You Wanted to Know episode, we're going to be delving into the history of the Capetian dynasty. So how did this royal line hold on to the French throne for such a long time in the Middle Ages? How did deep-seated religious beliefs shape their rule? And what was the Capetian miracle? Speaking to Emily Briffitt, historian Justine Fernharbour-Baker answers your questions on the influential French dynasty. From how they popularised the name Philip and the iconic fleur-de-lis to their religiously inspired royal touch.
So we are going to be talking about everything you wanted to know about the Capetians. All of the list of questions, all of the big topics. So first question for you is the biggest of them all. Who were the Capetians?
Yeah, and I'm sure for many people, that's a really good question. They're not exactly a household name, particularly if you didn't grow up in France. And even for a lot of people who did grow up in France. So the Capetians, it's amazing that they're not actually that well known because they were the dynasty, the royal family that ruled the Kingdom of France from 987 to 1328. Sometimes, if you do hear the Capetians referred to, it might be in reference to the entire royal dynasty up to the revolution. But if you're a medieval historian, we speak specifically about the 15 kings who ruled between the coronation of Hugh Capet, the first Capetian king in 987, and the heirless death of the last Capetian king, Charles IV, in 1328. Then another dynasty, the Valois, takes over, and after them, the Bourbons. Sometimes they're referred to as Capetians as well, but it's really that dynasty between 987 and 1328 that we think about when we think about the Capetians.
That's perfect. Now, where did the name Capetian actually come from?
Ah, yeah, that's an interesting story. So the term Capetian is a modern invention. It was invented during the French Revolution, actually. Because when the revolutionary government sent Louis XVI to the guillotine, they wanted to give him a surname, like he was just a regular citizen. So they actually sentenced him as Citoyen Louis Capet, Louis Capet. And so the adjectival form Capetian was kind of a term of abuse for anything that was like pre-revolutionary, feudal, not modern. But it actually comes from a genuine medieval nickname given to the first Capetian ruler, this man named Hugh. And we're not actually quite sure what the nickname means exactly. Well, it means short cloak, but does it refer to a cloak that he was wearing? Or does it have to do with his family's association with the shrine of Saint Martin of Tours, who Saint Martin was famous for giving his cloak to a beggar? And maybe that makes more sense. Hugh wasn't actually given this nickname during his lifetime, that actually develops over the next century, but it is a medieval nickname. So people in the Middle Ages knew who Hugh Capet was.
So this brings us on to a question from, we actually have from a listener, which is from Laura J. Olson on Facebook. And she's asked, what can you tell us about Hugh Capet and what was he like?
Yeah. Well, a lot of legends grew up over the centuries. Dante thought he was a sort of low-born butcher who kind of took over the realm as a usurper. And there are stories that in the Middle Ages that the reason he was called Hugh Capet was because he wore a cap instead of a crown because he was ashamed of how he took over the kingdom. Now, these are all later legends, and they don't actually reflect anything about the circumstances of how he really came to the throne, which we'll get into, I imagine. Hugh was actually from a very powerful family, whom we actually call the Robertians. The distinction between Robertians and Capetians is kind of a false one, kind of an artificial distinction. So they were a line of great princes. Actually, three of them had already been kings of the kingdom that Hugh came to rule. They had very powerful connections also in the German Empire. Hugh's mother was the sister of the German emperor, and he was very wealthy. He had great lands in northern France around Tours, Orléans, Paris. He was also a really great soldier, and he was kind of the previous king's right-hand man in terms of soldiering. He was very pious. There's a funny story about how one time he was visiting this really important abbey, the Abbey of Saint-Denis, north of Paris, and he came across naked lovers fornicating outside the chapel, and it made him want to reform the abbey. We also know that he had a really good marriage. He was married to a noblewoman named Adela of Aquitaine, and he refers to her in his letters as our companion and our sharer in our power. And he actually sends her on diplomatic missions. So we don't know a lot about Hugh, but what we do, I think, is quite interesting and a bit beguiling even.
So you mentioned that we'd come onto it, and we definitely are. So how did the Capetians come to power?
Okay, this is a little bit of a complicated story, so you'll just have to bear with me. Okay, so the kingdom that Hugh comes to rule in those days was called West Francia. And it is a successor state to the empire of Charlemagne. Charlemagne becomes emperor of the West in 800. He rules most of what is now Europe. But in 843, his grandsons, who have been having a civil war, divide the empire. And there is an East Francia, sort of a forerunner of Germany, a West Francia, sort of the forerunner of France, and a kingdom in the middle that is literally called the Middle Kingdom. Yeah, it is soon called Lotharingia, but it pretty soon gets absorbed into East Francia. So West Francia, the forerunner of France, Hugh's kingdom, is ruled by the descendants of Charlemagne's youngest grandson, Charles the Bald. So this dynasty we refer to as the Carolingians, the West Frankish Carolingians. And they rule until 888, when a king called Charles the Fat abdicates. And he is succeeded actually by the first king of Hugh's line, a man named Odo. And since 888, the Robertians, Hugh's line, and other Carolingians have kind of been trading that thrown back and forth. And sometimes they're competing, going to war against one another. Sometimes they're cooperating. So just before Hugh is elected to the throne, which I'll get to in a second, the Carolingian kings were Lothar, whom Hugh had actually been quite close with for a while. They're actually cousins, and he's kind of Lothar's right-hand man for a long time. Lothar dies in 986, and his son, Louis V, comes to the throne. Louis is 18. He dies in a hunting accident about a year later. And it's at that point that Hugh is chosen king of the Franks, because Louis V has not left a son. He's only 18. He has managed to get divorced, even at the young age of 18, but he's not left a son. There is a Carolingian possibility. So Louis's uncle, Lothar's brother, a man named Charles of Lorraine, but a big assembly of nobles and prelates is held, and they choose Hugh over Charles. And the reason they do that is, one, because Hugh had the support of the German emperor, or actually the German emperor is a minor at this point. So the German emperor's mother, who's a Byzantine princess named Theophano, who is wonderful. We could talk about her too, but we're not going to. So that's really important. But the other problem was that Charles of Lorraine had really disgraced himself by marrying a lowborn woman. So a speech was made by an archbishop that says, you know, actually, this man, Hugh Capet, is the best one for the kingdom. And so the assembly agreed, and then he was crowned and then taken to the holy city of Reims, where he was anointed. And the line never returned to the Carolingians. Charles of Lorraine did make war on Hugh and try and take back the throne, but he was captured and put in prison in Orléans and just kind of disappears.
Thank you. That's answered a question you've actually had from the Golden from Golden on Instagram, who was asking about what happened to the dynasties that came before the Capetians. But the one thing I really want to ask you is, swirling around the Capetians is this idea of the Capetian miracle. What do we mean when we're talking about this?
Okay, so when Hugh comes to the throne, West Francia is kind of a client kingdom of the German Empire, and actually, over the first century of the Capetian dynasty's reign, it actually becomes considerably less powerful, and the kings of France considerably less powerful over that period. So that by the time you get to around the year 1100, the French kings are really just ruling a tiny area around Paris, and they're subject to attacks, not even from great lords, but even from little lords who are just holding a castle or two around Paris. They are also faced with an enormous threat from England and Normandy, because in the beginning of the Capetian dynasty, the Norman dukes had really been on the Capetian side. But once William becomes really strong, and he starts out under the guardianship of the French king, but once he becomes really strong and then conquers England, he's much more powerful than the Capetians. So the Capetians are really, really on the back foot in 1100. But over the course of the 12th century, they become a bit stronger, holding their own, fighting back these castellans. And then we get to the reign of someone called Philip Augustus, who takes the throne as a 15-year-old boy in 1180. He is completely overshadowed by Henry II at first, but by the time his reign ends in 1226, he has not only taken back Normandy, but also Anjou, the Touraine, Poitou, and he's also conquered the Languedoc because of a crusade against some heretics down there called the Albigensian Crusade. So suddenly he's ruling this enormous kingdom, and he's also revolutionized its government. By the time Philip Augustus dies, there is a chancery in Paris that's keeping track of all the government's business. There's a sort of rudimentary tax system, and you're really beginning to get some of the political, ideological supports of Capetian government in place. And then his grandson, Louis IX, whom we now call St. Louis, Saint Louis, just almost explodes that in some really successful ways. A lot of it actually is through government, but also through increasing the religious prestige of the Capetian kings. They've always had that to draw upon since the reign of Louis VII, who was Eleanor of Aquitaine's first husband. They've been known as the most Christian kings, and the oil that they are anointed with supposedly comes directly from heaven, which is different from other kings of Europe. So they've got these supports to draw upon. Oh, they also supposedly can heal people just with their touch, the royal touch. But Louis goes on crusade. His crusades are a complete failure, but that almost makes him more holy, right? Because it's almost a martyrdom. And Louis adopts all these ascetic practices. He even has himself whipped. And then when he dies on crusade. So it really is like a martyrdom. Supposedly, his corpse starts performing miracles. And then he's sainted in 1297. So by the time we get to 1300, France is large, it's rich, and it's really the most admired kingdom, as well as the most powerful kingdom in Christendom.
This episode is brought to you by Indeed. We're driven by the search for better, but when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/History Extra. Just go to Indeed.com/History Extra right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
This episode is brought to you by Etsy. Looking to instantly upgrade your Mother's Day gift from typical to meaningful? Shop Etsy. Now until May 12th, get up to 30% off personalized jewelry, style, decor, and so many other items mom will love. And if you want her to know you put a ton of thought into her present, use Gift Mode. Gift Mode on Etsy takes the stress out of gifting so you can easily find well-crafted, original, and affordable pieces from small shops. Just tap or click Gift Mode on your Etsy app or Etsy.com. Then answer a few short questions about mom, and Gift Mode instantly gives you curated ideas based on hundreds of personas. Need something original and affordable for Mother's Day? Etsy has it. Shop until May 12th for up to 30% off gifts for mom. Terms apply.
Today Healthier is happening at CVS Health in more ways than you've ever seen. It's wellness destinations for seniors, including select locations with Oak Street Health and CVS Pharmacy. It's doctors, nurses, pharmacists, and everyone in between, offering quality care and support virtually, in person, and on the phone. It's in-home evaluations through Signify Health and meeting mental health needs through Aetna. And those are just a few of the ways Healthier is happening. To see more, visit cvshealth.com/healthierhappenstogether. CVS Pharmacy, Oak Street Health, CVS Specialty, Signify Health, and Aetna are part of CVS Health. Eligibility and services vary by location and individual.
There is so much there I'd really like to touch upon. While we're talking about Louis, could you just tell us a little bit more about him, how he goes on to become a saint and why he's so revered?
Yeah, okay, so Louis is a very lucky king in many ways because he inherits Philip Augustus's accomplishments. And also his father only reigns for 3 years, but it's his father who really completes the conquest of the Languedoc. But what's really lucky about Louis is his mother. So when his father dies, he's still a minor. And the regency is taken over by his mother, Blanche of Castile. And she is this incredibly capable woman. She faces down a baronial revolt. She institutes governmental reforms of her own. She's actually responsible for what we call the first real piece of Capetian legislation. And she also sort of inculcates this family solidarity among Louis and his brothers and his one sister that really means that they're all kind of building the Capetian state together rather than being at loggerheads. She also instills this piety in him, which is going to help make his reputation. But as he grows older, Louis begins to find his mother quite overbearing. And it's around, you know, he's getting to be in his late 20s, and Blanche really isn't kind of giving over the reins of control. And then Louis falls sick, and he promises God that if he gets well, he will go on crusade. And so modern scholars see this as Louis's kind of moment of breaking free from Blanche. The Crusade is a terrible failure, but it really makes his name. But because it's a failure, he comes back to France, and Blanche has died at this point, a much chastened man. And so he undertakes this program to reform himself, but also to reform his kingdom. And that actually inculcates a lot of resistance, but it also really burnishes his reputation. And he also becomes very involved with the mendicants, these monks who are dedicated to poverty. So that burnishes his reputation as well. He's sainted in 1297, so 27 years after he dies, by a pope who is really actually doing that partly to tell the current French king, a man named Philip the Fair, you need to live up to the reputation of your grandfather. So Louis's sainthood is very helpful to the reputation of the Capuchin kings, but it's also sort of a stick to beat them with. Are you like Saint-Louis or not?
Would it be fair to say that the Capuchins had this real Christian mythos surrounding them?
Yeah, very much so. So there is that holy chrism that I've mentioned. So the story about this holy chrism, this was made up in the 9th century to benefit the Carolingians, actually, is that a dove brought this oil down from heaven for the anointing of the first Christian king of the Franks, Clovis, around the year 500. So right from the beginning, they're special. And then from the reign of the second Capuchin king, they're believed to have this touch that can heal the sick. At first, it can heal lepers. Later on, it's people with this throat condition called scrofula. Then in the reign of Louis VII, Eleanor of Aquitaine's first husband, they get the epithet Most Christian King, which is bestowed upon them because Louis VII shelters Becket from Henry II. Of course, he can't shelter him forever, but it, you know, redounds to his credit and is something that a real contrast with Henry II. And then, of course, with Henry II's children, the Devil's Brood. Under Louis IX, of course, there's a real increase in the sense of France, not only France having the most Christian king, but France itself being the most Christian nation. And that comes from a couple of different developments over the period around the turn of the 13th century, around the year 1200. One is that the Capuchins acquire some really important relics, including the crown of thorns, which makes it seem almost like God has bestowed his crown upon them. And then there is a second, much darker development, which is the Capuchins really begin to acquire a reputation for being the persecutors of non-Christians, specifically Jews within their own kingdom. One of Philip Augustus's first acts as king in 1180 is to expel the Jews from France and to take all their goods, and then also through crusade as well, and then through the Albigensian Crusade, persecutors of heretics. So there's their own piety, but there's also the persecution of non-believers.
Is this something that we actually see throughout the entire Capuchin dynasty, or does it ebb and flow?
Yeah, I mean, there are some early signs of it. So the first burning of a heretic happens under the reign of Robert the Pious in 1022. But it really picks up over the course of the 13th century with the establishment of inquisitory processes. And then it really reaches a crescendo in the reign of Philip the Fair, Philip the Fourth, who reigns from 1285 to 1314. And there's a French historian who actually calls this moment the demonic turn, when not just Capuchin France, but Europe, I think especially Capuchin France, begins to take on a much more not just persecutory character, but paranoid character in ways that I think maybe the general public really associates with the entirety of the Middle Ages, but actually really only becomes intense at the end of it, at the beginning of the 14th century, when people start doing things like accusing the Pope of having a personal demon, or accusing a bishop of trying to kill the queen by making a little voodoo doll and sticking it all over with pins and throwing it into the fire. And this also gets linked with accusations of sodomy, which was, okay, technically a crime, but not one that was really punished until the end of the 13th century. And it often sodomy and demonic leanings, evil magic, become linked. So Pope Boniface VIII, who's actually responsible for canonizing Louis IX, Philip the Fair accuses him, yes, of keeping a private demon, of being a sodomite, of worshiping idols. And then he goes and in 1307 does the exact same thing with the Templars, which ultimately leads to the burning of 54 Templars in Paris and the disbanding of the entire order, this crusading order that had been around for 200 years. So it's a very strange moment when the world kind of seems to go crazy.
I wonder if you could just touch on how they balance this relationship with being very pious, but also being seen as persecutors. I think that's a really interesting dynamic.
Yeah, for the Middle Ages, that's not a contradiction. Particularly from the 12th century, we talk about something the historian R.I. Moore calls the rise of a persecuting society, where Christianity, particularly in its relationship with the state, becomes as much about rooting out difference and disbelief and difference of belief as it does about enforcing orthodoxy. Well, that's the way of enforcing orthodoxy. And particularly with the importance of the Crusade in France, and France really is the birthplace of the Crusade. If you look at who goes on the First Crusade, it's the French. It's Louis VII who initiates the Second Crusade. The Third Crusade is also partly French. And then, of course, Louis IX, his Crusades. The Crusade is about persecuting non-believers and taking back land for the Orthodox, for the Christians. There's not really a way to separate out piety and persecution from the end of the 11th century on, maybe even before that.
Thank you. I think that's a really interesting point just to touch on. But I think we should probably backtrack a little bit. One thing I actually wanted to ask you is, one of the things that the Capetians are known for is this long line of very successful succession. Could you just tell us a little bit about, this is something we've had lots of listener questions from Instagram, from Twitter or X now, just about why did their dynasty rule for so long and how it was able to be so stable?
Yeah, okay, so a lot of it's just down to luck. It's actually amazing that there was an unbroken line of patrilineal succession for 12 generations. So between 987 and 1316, it passed from father to son. There was always a son. There were some times when it looked a bit dodgy. Philip Augustus was Louis VII's only son. It really looked like it might end there. But they just kept getting lucky until they didn't anymore. In 1316, Louis X doesn't have a son. So for the first time, the throne has to pass to a brother rather than a son. Actually, he has a posthumous son who dies 4 days after his birth. So there is a son, but does it really count? Not really. So that's a lot of luck. Although there is some skill in that they never face a major baronial rebellion that threatens to overthrow them, that they never have a cadet line, a younger brother who says, actually, I should be king. The closest that ever comes is during Louis IX's minority, when Blanche of Castile is regent, and she is just so good at facing it down, at making alliances that counteract that baronial rebellion, the challenge from Louis's uncle, that it's okay. A lot of it is just down to sheer dumb genealogical luck, though.
Agrobiodiverse on X has asked us about the capability of individual monarchs and whether this also played a role in the stability.
Very much so, I think. There are times when the Capetians had very weak kings, incapable monarchs, and you do really see a downturn in their fortunes. Philip I, around the year 1100, was a very weak king. He got involved in an adultery scandal, and it just really ruined all of his alliances, got the Pope against him, was a big problem. But it is true that the Capetian success is not down to luck, but really down to people like Philip Augustus, like Blanche of Castile, like Louis IX, and indeed like Philip IV, who was a very unattractive person in his personal qualities. Apparently he was one of the most beautiful men in the world, but very unattractive in terms of his character, but also a very strong king. And then when you get weak kings like a couple of his sons, yeah, those fortunes turn down again. So it does have to do with the personality of the monarch. It's not just luck.
Is it possible to perhaps break down this period of long rule into moments of prosperity and misfortune at all?
Yeah. So you actually start out pretty strong under Hugh Capet's son, Robert the Pious. Robert conquers the Duchy of Burgundy and he really founds this reputation of Capetian kings as pious, as miracle workers, as people with a special relationship with the church and with God. His successors, though, are increasingly weak. During this period of the rise of Normandy, the rise of the Castellans, Louis VI, who rules from 1108 to 1137, who is rather comically known as Louis the Fat, was what he was known as at the time. But despite that nickname, he's a very strong king. And it's really because of him that the Capetians fight back against the Castellans. And there's a lot of ideological development under his reign as well, in partnership with the Abbey of Saint-Denis, this abbey that's just north of Paris, which is where all the French kings are buried. It's where the chronicle tradition of the Capetian monarchy starts. It's where Gothic starts, actually. So Louis VI's reign is a real watershed moment, even though his son, Louis VII, is maybe not so much a strong king. But then his son is Philip Augustus. And that's when we get that real moment. Okay, now the Capetian miracle can take off. And that really lasts until sometime in the reign of Philip the Fair, Philip IV, who dies in 1314. And then things go downhill really quickly. Like, I'm reminded of those memes where someone's just like walking along and then suddenly stumbles and then like they break a window and like sirens are going off. Those last three kings are just a disaster and the kingdom really falls apart. The first one comes to the throne at the end of 1314, dies in 1316, no son except for this little boy who lives for 4 days. Crown passes to his brother, Philip V, who rules from 1316 to 22. He dies without a son, passes to his brother, Charles IV. He dies without a son, and that's the end of the dynasty. So you would think in 1314, Philip the Fair has three sons. Surely things are going to be all right. And then it's just a disaster. It's just gone so quickly.
And I think we're probably going to come back to this bit of this dramatic fall. But I think we should probably focus on the highs or the relative highs first. Could you tell me a little bit about how the region moved from being this sort of insecure foothold around Paris to becoming this quite widespread nation? How did that happen and how much of a role did the Capetians as individuals have in that?
Yeah, that's their work. I would say that the territorial expansion, absolutely, you can lay that at the feet of the Capetians and their military skill, their political acumen. The original Capetian lands, so their original family lands in the north of France, are fairly restricted but wealthy. And the Kingdom of West Francia is huge. It's actually probably bigger than France today because it includes Catalonia. But Hugh has really very nominal control over all of this. And the great princes, the great dukes and counts pretty much do their own thing in their counties and duchies. And Hugh leaves them alone as long as they leave him alone. And of course, things go kind of sideways once William of Normandy, William the Conqueror, creates his cross-channel empire. But the Capetians just kind of bide their time. And so once you get to Philip Augustus, he is in a good position to know what the strengths and weaknesses of the Plantagenets are. So there's constant warfare between Normandy and France in this period. And so once Henry's sons start rebelling against him. The Capetians have this long time-tested strategy of playing the Plantagenets, first the Normans and the Plantagenets, off against one another because they're always fighting. So they always adopt this strategy of divide and conquer. And so Philip Augustus can do that with Henry II and his sons. Then once Henry is dead, he can do it with Richard and his brothers. And then once John is on the throne, well, goodness help all of us once John is on the throne, right? He's known as John the Bad for a reason. People have tried to rehabilitate him, but goodness, he was not a good monarch. You can divide and conquer John and his barons. Philip Augustus is a very good general. He's also a very good politician. And he's also very good at marriage strategy and making sure that some of the great baronies, where there isn't an heir, isn't a clear heir, well, we'll just absorb those into the crown. Yeah, why not? It's interesting that Philip Augustus isn't interested in the Albigensian Crusade at first. He has his hands full with John. So when he is approached to say, you know, will you go down and deal with the heretics? He's like, no. If my lords, my vassals want to go down there, that's fine. I myself am not doing that. His son wants to go down. And it is his son who actually completes that work. By the time you get to Louis IX, basically the borders are pretty set. And there's not a lot more expansion that happens. They gain some small things like the city of Lyon. But I don't think they ever actually give up that expansionist dream. So when Louis goes on crusade in 1248, he heads for Egypt. That's the way they're going to get to Jerusalem, is pushing through Egypt. He actually seems to have it in his mind that he might conquer Egypt and colonize it. So they never really give up this idea that, okay, maybe there are more lands out there for us. They try and get themselves elected a Holy Roman Emperor. A Capetian cadet does take over the kingdom of Naples in southern Italy. So there is this constant expansionary idea there that ends up running up against some limits. But I don't think that that idea is ever really extinguished.
Now, one thing you mentioned there was the Capetian interaction with the Angevins and the Plantagenets. Obviously, there's the big elephant in the room. How responsible would you say that they almost were for sowing the seeds of 100 Years' War?
Oh, absolutely. I tend to think of the Capetians as, for me, because I think the 14th century is the best century of the Middle Ages. I think of the Capetians as sort of a prelude to the 100 Years' War. You can see it. If you know it's coming, you can really see it. Certainly as you could say, okay, back to 1066. That's the break. Certainly when Eleanor of Aquitaine marries Henry Plantagenet, the future Henry II, who is then Count of Anjou, in 1152, bringing him Aquitaine, this huge dowry that had belonged to Louis VII. I think really that's the moment, because those lands could never really be separated from France, but they could never really be separated from England either. And that creates a permanent problem that persists even after the French conquest of Normandy, that the French kings have ultimate jurisdiction over Aquitaine, eventually just Gascony, and the English kings have to do the ceremony of homage to the French kings for this duchy. And that is a very humiliating ceremony, as well as having implications about French jurisdictional supremacy. So when you're doing homage, you kneel in front of your lord and you put your hands between his or her hands. And no king wants to do that. So it's there certainly from 1152. There are moments of rapprochement between them. Louis IX and Henry III are very close. They're brothers-in-law. They have very similar attitudes toward religious piety. But it's just, I think the geopolitics of it are just so problematic that it was always going to end up in war. Did it have to be the Hundred Years' War? Well, it's only became that because it became not just that sort of old-fashioned feudal conflict between the Duke of Gascony and the King of France, his lord, but also war for the crown of France. And that actually has a lot to do with choices that Philip the Fair's sons made in that period where the crown is passing from brother to brother, that created some real resentments among French nobility that were hard to address any other way than war.
So I guess we should probably talk about that particular moment. Could you tell us a little bit about this sort of downturn in the fortunes of with brother versus brother almost?
Yeah, so we call this period the period of the cursed kings, which is actually the title of a series of books by a French author. They're fictional, but they're wonderful. So if you look up the Cursed Kings series, they're great. Don't believe everything they say, but they are based on fact. So as I said, Philip the Fair had four sons, Louis, Philip, and Charles, and one daughter, Isabel. Isabel was sent to England to marry Edward II as a way to end a war in Gascony, actually. These sons, very early, even before Philip dies, we know there are problems because their wives are caught committing adultery. Yeah, which is a pretty crazy thing to happen to the Capetians, who part of their piety is that they're known as incredibly chaste. They actually do seem to be faithful to their wives, right? So for the wives not to be faithful to their husbands is pretty amazing. And of course, it cast doubt on the paternity of their children. So the daughters-in-law, two of them, are convicted and they are sent to a terrible cold castle. One of them dies a year later. The other one eventually dies in a nunnery, but they're out of the picture. And the men that they supposedly committed adultery with are flayed alive, castrated, and then hung in the public square in a city called Pontoise with the king looking on, right? So already we have really a shadow cast over these kings and over the children they have so far. Philip the Fair dies later that year, and his son, Louis X, takes the throne, as was always expected, but seems like haunted. It takes him 9 months even to have himself crowned. At the time, his adulterous wife is still alive, though she dies in mysterious circumstances some months later. Yes, probably murdered. And then once he finally does have himself crowned, almost the first thing that happens is he has a really unsuccessful war, and then we hear almost nothing from him for 9 months, and then he dies at like the age of 25, really mysteriously. There's an interregnum because he's left his wife pregnant. She has that son who doesn't live very long. And then there's a question as to whether the throne should pass to Louis X's daughter, 4-year-old girl named Joan, or whether his brother, Philip, should take the throne. And Philip really outmaneuvers everybody else, outmaneuvers this 4-year-old girl. Of course, the 4-year-old girl's paternity is questionable because it was her mother who was involved in this adultery scandal. But a lot of people do not feel good about what Philip has done. And what he has done is say the reason she can't inherit is because women can't have the throne of France. Later, this will be turned into the idea of the Salic Law, though we really don't get that until the 15th century. So there are a lot of people who feel that Philip shouldn't be king, and his coronation takes place basically under armed guard. And it's interesting, the chronicles say that when he goes back to Paris afterwards, he calls a big public assembly, says no women can inherit the throne of France, and the next thing that happens is his baby son, who turns out to be the only son Philip is ever going to have, dies. Yeah. Philip only lives for another 5 years. He suddenly sickens. People say maybe he was poisoned. I mean, people are actually bragging about maybe he was poisoned because he's such a bad king that we need to get rid of him. The succession that time isn't contested. He has left daughters, but it moves smoothly to his brother Charles IV. Charles IV goes through three wives, one son, stillborn. The wife dies like 3 days after that. He marries again immediately. When he dies, she's pregnant, but that time it's a girl. So it's as incredibly lucky as the Capetians had been for 300 years. In a manner of 14 years, they become incredibly unlucky. So unlucky that people said, maybe this is actually a curse because this is so incredibly surprising how this ended.
As we've been speaking, there have been so many interesting female characters in this, as well as the male characters. And so we've spoken about Blanche of Castile, we've talked about Eleanor of Aquitaine, we've also got these adulterous wives who obviously seem to be playing quite a big part in the fortune of the Capetian dynasty. Could you tell us a little bit what influence women had over the Capetian dynasty?
Yeah, it's really important when we think about power in the Middle Ages to realize it's really a family affair. And that means that women are always very important as wives, as mothers, as daughters. Not in the case of the Capetians, but in a case of about 20% of powerful families in Europe, the family is headed by a woman because those are just the accidents of genealogy and blood is generally more important than sex to people in the Middle Ages. So yeah, a lot of these women are really important, particularly the mothers. We've talked about Blanche. Eleanor, when she is married to Louis VII, is very important as a wife. She has great influence over Louis VII because he is just besotted with Eleanor. So he does a lot of what she tells him to do, which, since they are both teenagers, is not always maybe the cleverest of moves, but she has a lot of influence there. And if she had managed to give him a son, I think she always would have been Queen of France. The reason they get divorced doesn't have to do with Eleanor needing to be free or anything like that. It's that she doesn't seem to be able to produce boys with Louis. She then does produce a lot of boys with Henry II, so Louis doesn't feel that great about that. But there are also women who influence the Capetian family, the Capetian power, that are very powerful, but not necessarily in ways that strengthen Capetian power. So Philip I, I talked about him, this very weak king around the time of the First Crusade. He falls in love with the Count of Anjou's wife and elopes with her, which gets him and her excommunicated. And he can't give her up, even though it's really a big stumbling block for him politically and religiously. And she has a big influence over the kingdom. Robert the Pious, the second king of France, Hugh Capet's son, his second wife, Constance of Arles, they do not get along at all. So she has his favorite friend assassinated. She incites his sons in rebellion against him. Robert is always wanting to give away jewels and treasure to beggars. And, you know, she's threatening him about how he has to stop doing this. So, you know, she's a very strong woman. Louis IX's sister is another interesting case. And then there are so many, but I'll leave with Isabel. So Louis IX has lots of brothers, but only one sister. And normally with a royal daughter, her real value is her marriage, the marriage she's going to make. And in fact, they betroth her to the son of the Holy Roman Emperor, intending for her to be the empress. And she says, no. What I really want to do is to found a Franciscan nunnery. And that is what she does. And actually, some people think that Louis's own piety has to do with emulation of his sister, with his sister's model, because it's Isabel who defies Blanche's plans first. And after an illness as well, just as Louis IX is going to do when he decides to go on crusade. So there are a lot of really strong women in the Capetian story who are really changing the course of events.
There are so many interesting characters, it seems. If you had to pick one of the monarchs that most fascinate you or most intrigue you, or there's something a bit fun about them that just makes, you just can't put it into words, who would you pick?
Probably the one I don't think I've mentioned yet, who is Henry I. And we don't talk a lot about Henry the First. So he reigns from 1030 to 1061. And mostly what he does is kind of hold the fort down. But he does one really interesting thing. He marries a woman named Anne of Kiev. Why does he do this? Why does he marry a woman so far away? You know, she can't bring anything in terms of lands. She can't bring anything in terms of really useful political alliances. Now, Anne's father has a very clear matrimonial policy. He is marrying his offspring, his sister, off to any monarch he can find, right? But why is Henry interested in this? One thing that Anne does bring is this large red jewel, Anne's hyacinth, which disappears eventually. So she comes with this dowry of jewels, and she's a bit exotic, and she's actually the reason that so many Capetian kings are named Philip. At the time, Philip was a Greek name. People in the West didn't use it, but she names her son Philip, this Eastern name, and it just explodes in popularity. So there's this very mysterious moment there that I just like thinking about. What is going on there? Why did he do this? And what were things like for Anne? We know that she read and wrote because we actually have, she wrote her name in Cyrillic at the bottom of a document, right? So this is a woman who is very interesting, but we just don't know that much about them.
I think, obviously, when we think of the French monarchy, we do think of the Louis and the Philips. There are lots of Louis and Philips. But also something like the fleur-de-lis.
Ah, yes.
Were the Capetians responsible for popularising this?
Absolutely. The fleur-de-lis is, I guess I shouldn't say their fault, but the fleur-de-lis is a Capetian invention. So we first see it adopted on the coins of Louis the Fat in the 1130s. And for those of you who don't know, the fleur-de-lis is the three-petaled lily. Once you start looking for it, you see it everywhere because it has become this almost ubiquitous motif. But in the 12th century, it's very closely associated with the Capetians, and it probably has some association with the Virgin Mary, whose cult is becoming very popular, with virginity, with purity. Later on, at the end of the 13th century, the three petals are said to represent the three important qualities of France. So faith, wisdom, and chivalry. And you need all three petals for the lily to flourish, right? By the reign of Philip Augustus, it's really taken off. So Philip wore robes embroidered with flowers, which we think are fleur-de-lis. We know that he carried a fleur-de-lis banner. His first wife, Elizabeth of Hainaut, when her grave in Notre Dame was excavated, we found that she was buried with a silver medallion, which has her holding the fleur-de-lis, the lily in one hand and a scepter in the other. And it becomes absolutely the emblem of France and its status as a pure Christian nation. So, you know, there are some dark elements there too. And then in the 14th century, as the Capetian line both ends and splinters, right? Because there are still people out there with Capetian blood, it starts to pop up other places. So when Edward III claims the French crown, which he does in 1340, part of what he does is have new banners made where the lions of England are quartered with the lilies of France. And another claimant, the King of Navarre, who also has Capetian blood, he also quarters the lily on his banners. The Burgundian dukes, who are descended from the Capetians, put the lily on their heraldry as well. So it really becomes something that you see sort of everywhere.
To round up everything we've spoken about in this conversation, could you tell us a bit about the Capetians' legacy? What would you say are their most significant achievements, but also failings?
Yeah, okay. Well, we'll start with the good stuff. So I think fundamentally, the Capetians are to be credited with creating France as a territory. There were some things that weren't part of it when they ended. Provence doesn't become part of it until the 15th century, Brittany the same, etc. But France as an integral geographic political space, that's the Capetian legacy. We've talked about Gothic, we've talked about the fleur-de-lis. And then they are responsible for creating an important part of French national identity. There are ways in which that is not a good legacy. There are ways in which that is, I think, pretty much a really poisoned legacy, in that it is built on persecution as well as on a sense of community. And that's not something I've talked about, but the Capetians did build a sense of, we are French people and we are a political community, a national community. And for them, that also meant a religious community. But I don't think it's absolutely necessary, that part of it. So there are lots of other contributors to French national identity. I mean, you know, we have the Enlightenment, the Revolution, the World Wars, post-colonialism. But there is a substratum of French national identity that absolutely owes to the Capetians and really is a continuing legacy of theirs, even if not an uncomplicated one.
That was Justine Fern Harbour Baker, Professor of History at the University of St Andrews and the author of House of Lilies, The Dynasty That Made Medieval France, which is out now, published by Allen Lane. Thanks for listening. This podcast was produced by Daniel Kramer-Arden.